Politicians struggle to enact the things they run on, that regardless of who wins elections, lawmakers find they cannot pass whatever legislation they like. They find themselves bound by what is popular, or at least their sense of it. They can only act within a narrow set of ideas, and that range is called the Overton Window. And on the Overton Window podcast, we look at issues around the country and talk to the people who change what is politically possible. Now, how do we know what is popular? What do people think about something right now, and what does that mean to the feasibility of an issue? We live in a world where we can answer these questions, or at least approximately answer them, and that's through polls. And so today I'm happy to be joined by Aaron Norman, the Lee Family Fellow and Senior Director of Communication Strategies at the State Policy Network. Aaron, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
What can we learn from polls?
Oh, there's so much we can learn from polls. So first, obviously, is how Americans are thinking about an issue, what they feel about an issue, how they're framing issues, which I think is something that gets overlooked a lot, which is really just the context they think of issues in. So I think a lot of times people that work in the policy world are framing things on a much more technical basis, and the way voters actually think about things, or really people actually think about things, is more often in terms of emotions and values, and polls can help you capture some of those feelings, which can help you be stronger at messaging. The other thing you can see is the speed of which opinions change, or how opinions change over time. Two really good examples of this are attitudes about interracial marriage and gay marriage. There are some really cool charts that I think Gallup has put together where you can see just how quickly opinion changed on those issues, and that those charts are put together by getting polling data from different points in time. And then sort of my favorite thing that we can learn, again, being like for people who work in policy, is a check on our own circles. So a lot of people that work in policy tend to be surrounded by like-minded people, and there are ideas of, well, everybody would like this policy, it's so great, or everybody probably hates this thing because it has all of these negative consequences. And to be able to look at some data that kind of pulls you out of your bubble and makes you realize, like, oh, I guess there are a couple of different ways people come at this issue. I think that is one of the biggest things that we can learn that helps us be more effective in the way we talk about things.
When you say that framing is overlooked, can you talk more about that?
Yeah. So when you think about an issue like, let's say, healthcare regulation, if you are working in the policy world in DC, in state legislatures, you're probably thinking about that from a lot of the technical pieces of it, right? So over 10 years, it's going to cost us this much more money, or implementing this particular regulation is going to be virtually impossible. But when you think about it from the voter, consumer, patient's point of view, well, yeah, I want them to do all of these things to protect my privacy. I'm not thinking about the fact that what they are asking nurses and doctors and hospital administrators to do is going to cost millions of dollars and be really complicated. I'm thinking about my privacy. And so framing it as that, right? Like, what is the frame of mind that voters are coming to an issue with, and how is that maybe different from how our messaging is framed?
So let's talk a little more about that, just because I think it is an important thing that polls can help us understand. When you say that it's helpful to understand how voters approach or at least enter into an issue, what they're thinking about when they're talking about healthcare or anything else, how is that going to be useful in messaging to them?
Sure. So a lot of times,
The question is for my case, it's not necessarily messaging to them, because I'm not trying to get people to vote for me. I'm trying to help, like, on my issues and the issues that I care about, I'm trying to figure out how to persuade people that the policy that I think is good is actually good to them, and phrase that in a way that's not just me telling them why I think an issue is good, but some type of an effective way to communicate to them why this thing that I think is good should appeal to them.
So one of the ways you can do this is when you're talking about kind of a bigger issue, right? Healthcare, immigration. There are polling questions you can ask that get at kind of why is this an important issue for you, and you can do that and have people respond in an open-ended fashion, or you can give them like a list of things I'm worried about. So for immigration, say like, I'm worried about jobs, I'm worried about crime and safety. I just don't think we should let more people into the country, right? What is the thing that is driving your opinion? And then if you see the results of that, you can say, okay, we need to make sure that when we're talking about this, we're explaining how our policy addresses this concern that people have. So the kind of weird thing about policy, right, is that there you can have these big policies that actually address a lot of concerns under the same issue, and you have to make sure that you are explaining what the policy is and what it does to voters in terms of what it is they care about. Like again, the healthcare, the Affordable Care Act, I think is just a really good example on this all around because of all of the things that went into that in terms of communication and the complexity of the policy. What people were hearing or their concerns about healthcare were that it was really expensive, and that it was unavailable to a large number of people, right? So you had pre-existing conditions and you had this like gap in your early 20s. And that's what the Obama administration focused on. Whereas some of the other concerns, right, there was a lot of discussion about from the right about implementation and overall cost. And like people weren't really thinking about that. Because their primary concerns were, I can't get healthcare or it's unaffordable. They weren't really concerned about like, well, how much is the government spending on healthcare, or you know, all of the detailed regulation bits that like we know became problematic, because that's not what they were focused on. And so I think it would have been right. We knew all of that going in. And probably would have been better off trying to counter some of the messages on the facets of the law that people were really most interested in, rather than talking about something else which appealed to generally like a much smaller segment of the population.
So I want to talk more or follow up on that, because I think it exposes a thing as a policy person I am often frustrated with. And that is often the disconnect between the messages that are sold and what the policy actually does. If you are a dishonest person, or if you really believe that the things that you're asking for are going to provide good impacts regardless of any evidence that they will, but it's just like they sold this as, you know, and it's right in the, or at least for the healthcare, or they sold it as the Affordable Care Act. And it has not made healthcare more affordable. Like, it's a fundamental disconnect, but they messaged on that one point. And I suspect that you're right, is that those, when you looked at polling, you said people are really worried about cost and access. And so we're going to say that we're going to do something about cost and access, regardless of whether we make the problem worse or not. So I guess, can you riff on that? What does polling tempt people into aggrandizement, or can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, so the short answer is yes. Like, the temptation is definitely there if you have data that says people want X, to just spin it and say, oh, this creates X, like they did on the Affordable Care Act. It did increase access, right? Like you can look at some of the things that were done there, and they did create access where access wasn't there before, came at a cost. And that's where the affordable part comes in. I don't know, right? Like I was not a part of that messaging team. Sure. I don't know for sure. But I suspect that the cost of healthcare popped on an like on as a key polling issue, and there was some degree of like, hey, let's run with that. That's how we're gonna get this across across the line. But when you do that sort of thing, right, there's always the short-term gain at a long-term cost, because we are now in a spot where healthcare is once again like unaffordable at a level where something is going to need to be done. And I think that the real benefit of having polling and other market research data is to identify those trends and to use that as a starting point for figuring out the right answer, right? So there's a combination of kind of policy research and then understanding what people care about and putting those together and saying, okay, how, like, what does good policy look like? And how can we use, like, how can we frame that good policy to solve this problem over here? And then, you know, the combination of that in messaging to say, hey, we really do have something that's going to fix this and here's how. You know, good liars throughout political history tend to do well in the short term. I don't know if we're ever going to change that. But I think knowing what people want and delivering that on that long term with good policy is probably going to get you further than anything else.
Yes, I think that's just an incredibly important point to drive home, which is you got to meet people where you are. If you are in the persuasion business, you have to persuade people about the things that they care about. You have to come at it with the understanding that they have of an issue, so that you're not talking over them or talking past them. And polls are really good at trying to help inform people to help them be more persuasive. So I guess let's kind of talk about some other things for polling. And I think the poll that most people are familiar with are the horse race poll, like, who's winning in this upcoming election at any given point in time. But what other kinds of polls are there?
So there's a lot you can do with polls. And so I separate between polling and then deeper market research. So polling is usually thought of as kind of that, you know, top level, who are you going to vote for presidents? You also get some issue questions in there. Do you support or oppose this major policy that's being talked about, like healthcare, infrastructure? You know, sometimes it's on less on specific pieces of legislation, but on things that are going on, like mask mandates, to get a sense of where, you know, how are people feeling about those issues at a really top level or top line, you know, situation. You can also use polls. So I will say that the vast majority of polling done, you will never see. So there's, you know, Gallup and Pew and around elections, the news organizations and campaigns will release polling, and they do that for kind of a PR reasons. But the majority of polling is kept internally and used for strategic reasons. So you get a fair amount that's done very quick turn on crisis comms. So, hey, this bad thing has happened. Like, have you heard about it? What do you think about it? What do you know? And that informs communications teams in responding to those kind of crisis situations.
Talk a little, give me an example of where that might be useful.
So you see it a lot in scandals or things that have gone really wrong. So like, I bet Bill Clinton's team in the late 90s did a lot of polling.
Okay, as in to say, how much have people heard about this? How much do people care? And do we have a message that could resonate or reframe it or bring some people around? Gotcha.
Right. And I mean, like, so what they ended up doing, my guess is what they ended up finding based on what they did and the general tone of the time was, the economy is great. I don't care.
Yeah.
Which is kind of the attitude that prevailed. BP, during the oil spill, like you see it a lot in corporate work, where there's something, like I said, that has gone really very wrong. And some people are paying a lot of attention to it, but how much does it cross over into like major news media? Yeah. I think some of that can be useful on the others, right? Like from the public side to say, hey, here is something that has gone really wrong. How much have you heard about it? What would you think about this type of legislation that would prevent something like this from happening again in the future? And that could be directed at either public, right? Like, hey, there's a loophole here that lets your congressman do all of these things that are super shady, or there's a, you know, this is something that's happening in the private sector that we should probably figure out a way to like close that loophole or deal with that from a government, you know, from a legislative point of view. You get a lot that's done in marketing on positioning and branding. So what do you think of of my brand? You look, what do you think of McDonald's and what are the things associated with McDonald's? And they'll use that to tweak marketing and communications. And then one of my favorite things that happens again, that's private and strategic, are segmentation studies, which is where you take a universe of people, whether it's registered voters or registered voters in a certain state, and then you use their attitudes and behaviors and demographic characteristics and kind of put them into these like-minded groups that then you can create targeting and messaging for. And the most famous one of these, right, so the term soccer moms is actually something that came out of a political segmentation in the 90s and said, hey, we have this group of moms, like they're working to some extent but not full career, and they have a bunch of kids and they live in the suburbs and they spend all their time just driving their kids around. You know, what are their concerns? How do we market to them? And you usually end up naming segments, and so this one got named soccer moms, and somehow that leaked out at some point and now everybody knows what a soccer mom is. So those are really fun. I think those are fun, but that's probably because I'm kind of nerdy. But you can get a lot of depth and understanding about different groups and how to talk to them. And the best thing about that, I think, is that it reframes it out of this political context. It's not, we have Republican soccer moms and Democratic soccer moms. We have soccer moms who share similar lifestyles and concerns, and how do we talk to them? And how do we make our message appeal to them? Again, absent that political piece, because they're probably not people that think about politics and policy as much as we do, which is a lot.
So I was, when you mentioned, I think what you're saying is marketing is this broader thing that like policy people, candidates, and not just for-profit industry or for-profit people need to understand who they're marketing to. There are lots of tools for marketing. Polls are one of those tools that you can have, and we can use them for strategic reasons. You covered some of them. What else are like, if you are selling an idea, what are polls going to be useful to you to do?
So if you're selling an idea or trying to find a market for your idea might be another way of looking at it. It can help you identify groups that your idea appeals to. So again, we tend to think of things in pretty pre-established groups, right? Like men and women, ages, political affiliation. Polling, if you get into the data and start looking at kind of the crosses of all of these groups, you can start to find audiences that will be more receptive to your ideas that you might not have thought of, or these combination of groups. Like, well, women typically aren't super excited about this idea, but when you look at this one, like middle-aged women in the suburbs are more receptive. So, you know, we can't ignore women altogether, because that's 52-51% of the population, and so we lose. But where we might have better luck is among these middle-aged women in the suburbs. And so let's do some targeting, like as we talk about our idea and we try to persuade people about our idea and educate them about our idea, let's concentrate our efforts on this particular group that might be more receptive to it. So that's one of the ways that it can help. Another is you can pull on specific language. So I've done a lot of work where you give people just a laundry list, right? 25, 30 words. And it's really quick hit. And you say, what's your first association, positive, negative, or neutral with these words? Mm-hmm. And you can use, synonyms, basically, like a lot of words that generally get at the same idea. And you'll see these massive differences where it's like, oh, Republicans have decided that is not the word they like. Or, young people think that word is awesome and older people think it's terrible. And so it can give you some data on actually crafting messages, like the specifics of use this word, don't use that word. And that can be really interesting and kind of fun.
I wanted to follow up on that one too, because this is something that I've personally used polls in my work for, which was I noticed that there seemed to be a big disconnect between, like, older people were very concerned that young people are socialists now. And, it's like, oh no, they don't know the terrorist socialism. Like, they don't remember all the problems that were associated with it. And when I was hearing the people who were sympathetic to socialism, I thought, they're talking about it, but it sounded like they just mean big government. Like, they're not talking about the state control of private industries. They just want a bigger and broader safety net, it seems. And we could actually use polls to say, okay, how do younger people actually think about this issue? What do they think of when they talk about socialism? And found that really there was a big disconnect for it, is that socialism became more of a buzzword for good policy or good active government policy to them than it had in the past. And I thought that was kind of an interesting result, because we do care about these opinions, these words, and our changing understanding, or at least there's a disconnect between how people use them.
Yeah, so. I mean, I think that's really important. Language evolves, and you can see this in a lot of ways. The starkest example I have recently is that during the pandemic, my son got really into the Hardy Boy books, which were written in like the 40s. And we had versions of them that had been updated in the 70s, but still you're reading it and you're like, this is not how people talk. None of these words mean what these words mean. Mm-hmm. And so language evolves, and I think polling is a really great resource to keep the pulse on how that language is evolving and what commonly understood definitions of words are. There is a point at which it can become difficult to let go of some of that, especially if you've got more technical expertise in a particular subject area, right? Like socialism. Socialism is the state controlling the means of production. That is the dictionary definition, but it's not what people think of it. Mm-hmm. Like, that's not how people think of it anymore. So if you're using messaging and saying, hey, socialism is bad, don't let the government take control of this industry, that's not going to resonate with a lot of people, because that's not what that word means. And so even though you know it's wrong, you have to kind of let go and use the common vernacular. And in a lot of cases, you're not going to know that unless you're checking it somewhere. And so I think polling is a really good resource for that.
How have some of your views changed by working on marketing and polling?
That's a really good question. I think I have discovered that there is a lot. So something polling has taught me, especially with message and language testing, is that there really isn't a silver bullet, right? It's not that if we just get the right words, people will understand. That moving people, using the right words, is very important. I want to make sure I'm clear on that. But using the right words to educate people is important, but you're not going to get like that perfect language that tests amazing and everyone just gets it all of a sudden. There are ways that you can get agreement with an individual statement, and yet people will vote the other way or support a different policy. And so one of the things that I have learned is that it's a slow moving process, and you really have to measure your progress all, like, the whole way through. So, okay, we've done this campaign. How have things changed? We're changing our language. How does things change now? There, when I started out in my career and was doing some training on long-term tracking polls, it was explained to me that if you see like a 10 or a 15 point jump within a year, something paradigm shifting had happened, right? Like a pandemic or a 9/11, or your data was wrong, right? That was like a, hey, you should go back because I think there's a coding error. So opinions change relatively slowly. And I think that's something that people kind of know, but working in polling has hit home for me that even as you see great campaigns and great like examples, or you see people getting experience with why something is good or bad, how opinions change over time is relatively slow. And you just kind of have to keep measuring it and keep, I mean, it's almost like experimental to see, okay, we did this. Like, is it having an effect in the right direction or not?
Mm-hmm. I think that's interesting because I would love it if there were magic words that you could use to get everyone to agree that subsidizing selective businesses is ineffective at creating jobs, unfair to other taxpayers, and expensive to the state budgets. That's not likely to happen, but I do want to see some progress. And polling is a way that we can use to measure whether we're making progress or not. And I think that's, given that there aren't magic words, what do you think does help move public opinion?
I think moving public opinion is a lot about highlighting things that are happening, right, that aren't theoretical. I think a lot of the political and policy messaging out there is theoretical. It's like, this could happen, or if we don't do this, this will happen. But storytelling of things that have happened do a lot to move the needle. And you can test a lot of those stories, right? You can do that with polling and research to say, here's a story, how much impact does that have? Mm-hmm. Are you more or less likely to think this is a problem after hearing this story, and pick the ones that are the most impactful? It's sort of like having kids, right? You can tell them a zillion times, like, don't touch the stove, it's hot. They stop touching the stove after they've touched the stove. So you need to have something that proxies for experience, so the stories of other people's experiences, or pointing out to them the experiences that they have had in their life. It's like, hey, you might not have realized this, but this thing happened because of this policy over here, and connecting the dots on that. I think that is what moves people. And then just a lot of time, right? Like, social norms and priorities shift over time in a lot of ways based on a lot of things that we can't predict. I think the most important thing is being there at those key moments with the right message, right? Okay, in this moment, what are people concerned about? What can we say to them that will connect, right, like the good or the bad based on whatever's happening, to these policies that we know will help prevent that bad or continue on that good that we have from this event at this like weird inflection point.
So can you tell me what work, I'm again as a think tank person, I think you are here to try and help us out with some things. Can you talk about some of the work or some of the ways that you help people like me market our issues?
Yeah. So I do a lot of work on polling and on audience identification. A lot of the work that I have done is about looking at values and emotions. So we, especially people who are well-versed in policy, tend to get into the weeds and talk about policy. And so a lot of the work I've done is using in-depth research techniques to drive people from the details of policy to how it makes them feel and how it connects to their values, and then helping think tanks and policy experts connect, like, okay, this is what this subsection says and does, and like, okay, help me ladder that up, right? What does that do? How does that change people's lives? How does that make them feel? Does it give them financial security? Does it give them a sense of accomplishment? Like, what is that thing that it ladders up to that is a little bit more accessible to the average person that you can use in your messaging? And so to connect, right, to make sure that they have facts to back that up, but then that there is some piece of that emotion and value in what you're saying that draws people in and gets them to pay attention. Because as I'm sure we're all aware, there is a lot of stimulus out there right now. You can be taking in messages from four or five sources at any given time, and that's pretty constant throughout your day. So our messaging, especially if it's on something that isn't top of mind for people, like tax policy, needs to have a draw in that people are going to stop and turn and pay attention.
Erin, good luck on your attempts to shift the Overton window.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Overton Window, a podcast from the Mackinac Center. Please subscribe and rate. For more, check us out at www.mackinac.org. That's Mackinac with a C, like the island.